Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
The topic today is a bit bloody, so please listen to discretion as advised. Welcome to the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Ever since my days working my way through college as a young lad at historic Fort Snelling in St. Paul, interpreting the life of a lowly private in 1827, I've been fascinated by the mythology and history of the bandits, cutthroats, and outlaws who prowled the Ohio River in the late 1700s. And that's why I was excited to talk to Don Harp, a descendant of two of the most bloodthirsty murderers in American history. Micajah and Wiley Harp, known to many as Big Harp and Little Harp, blazed a trail of absolute terror through Tennessee and Kentucky in the late 1790s. Don Harp recently appeared on an episode of Investigation Discovery about the brothers, and he's also written books about his infamous relatives, including The Last Rampage of the Terrible Harps, available for sale on Amazon. Thank you so much, sir, for joining me today. Now, how young were you when you first learned about the Harp brothers? And did someone in your family sit down and explain the blood connection, or did you find out through your own investigation?
No, I was probably 12, 13 when I first learned about them. But I learned about them through a article that was written in the Nashville, Tennessee newspaper. I found the article and I read it, and I asked my dad about it. And his only reply was, you know, he said, well, they are in our family history. We know about them, but we don't talk about them. And that was it. Bam. So what I had to find out, I had to find out by myself later. I managed, at one point in time, I talked to my dad's brother, asked him the same question, and got exactly the same answer. It was funny because some 15 or 20 years after that, when I was, well, maybe even more than that, I found that my dad had a couple of first cousins that I never knew anything about. I mean, had absolutely no idea that he had any first cousins. But I found the daughter of one of them, and I asked her about them. And her father, again, who was my dad's blood first cousin, told her exactly the same thing my dad told me. They're in the family, but we don't talk about them. So being as there were three different unattached, although they were kinfolk, I got the story from three different people at three different times and got the same story. I have to kind of believe that all of them were telling the truth, just that they're not going to talk about it. My dad would not even tell me his father's name.
Wow.
Yeah. I had to learn that after I got owned up and started. I decided I wanted to write a couple of books about them. And when I started doing, I did years of extensive background research. And after I started doing that, I found out my grandfather's name. And then I, of course, eventually found out a lot of details. So anything that I had to learn from research, which I did extensively. I went to the library in Madisonville, Kentucky. I did their microfiche files. I found the actual newspapers from 1799 when these accounts were actually printed. And I read and looked up every book that I could find. And then I had a friend that had a book that had been out of print since about 1850 that had the story in it. And he let me read that. So what I have pieced together over the years is simply what I have pieced together. I went under the assumption that three members of my family wouldn't be telling me the same thing at different times unless they knew what they were talking about. It's almost impossible to establish a direct bloodline other than what somebody in the family might tell you. They were so mean that in the early 1800s and mid-1800s, pretty much every branch of the family distanced themselves from Mukaijah and Wiley. We're the only ones that I know of that even will admit that they were even kinfolk at all. Most other ones just don't talk about it. They said, nope. We are, as far as I know, we're about the only branch of the Harps that have actually said, well, okay, they're actually in our history. We just don't, you know, we can't do anything about what happened 200 years ago.
Big Harp and Little Harp. Anyone who's seen the musical The Robber Bridegroom knows a comical, cartoony version of these two men, but from a historical perspective, and you just alluded to it now, these two fellas were absolutely no laughing matter. Can you talk about them? Who were they, and why are they so relevant to American history?
I think that their story is kind of it's almost an all-encompassing story of the year or two directly after the Revolutionary War. There were groups in and around the scenes of the battles where most of the battles took place, such as the Battle of Kings Mountain. There were men after the war that became what was called regulators. The regulators went out and decided that they would force everybody that fought for the British out of the country. And, of course, the Harp's father did fight for the British. The regulators came out and more than likely hung their father there in the front yard and probably their mother as well. So here we had two boys that were one of them 15, one of them maybe 13, or one maybe 14 and 12 in that neighborhood. They were 2 years apart. We have two boys that's left to fend for themselves completely. And I have a feeling that wasn't a lone story. I think that probably happened to quite a few people. The regulators saw an easy way to get land. You know, they could take anybody that fought for the Tories, they could just do anything they wanted to, and they did. So if they had land, they took it. But they left a lot of people displaced, a lot of families without fathers or without family. And the boys, the two Harp boys, just did the best they could do. They got by themselves, which meant they lived in the woods. They lived in caves. They hunted, they fished. And I'm sure that a lot of people, other people during that time were doing the same thing. However, there's not a lot of indication that a lot of them became serial killers, such as the Harps did. But that, of course, that happened a little bit later, and I believe it had something to do with revenge. I believe that it had something to do with the fact that they lived with the Cherokee Indian for about 12, 14 years, and that was right through their formative years. So I think they lived the best way they knew how. They got by the best way they knew how. And later, after people started accusing them of things which they may or may not have been guilty of, I have no way to know. But they were accused of several things after they moved to Knoxville. And they finally just went off a deep end and let their base nature, their hatred of a lot of people, just take over. And they did what they did, which in fact turned into a massive killing spree. They're interesting for our history because it shows that war does not always create good relations with the people that are left behind. And this time was one of them. And our history is filled with wars and with people that are left behind and with people that were displaced and taken advantage of after war. Look at the way the northern people, the northern carpetbaggers came and basically ran over people in the South after the Civil War. They took whatever they wanted. They took their lands. They took their houses. They took everything because they were the winners. So this is kind of the same thing that happened with the Harps. The the Tories were the enemy. The Patriots were the winners, and they did what they wanted to do. That makes it important because it points the way to how war doesn't really accomplish everything the way they say it does.
What you said brings to mind a recent story I read about the Younger brothers. Their father was pro-Union but shot by a Union soldier. And then Cole, Jim, and Bob Younger, the sons, turned to lives of outlawry and crime, basically out of anger and revenge.
Right. You know, the James brothers pretty much did the same thing, although they were fierce. Their mother was fiercely Southern. But it was kind of a result of a war that people weren't actually looking for. And I think the same thing happened with the Harps a few years earlier.
So tell us a little bit more about the brothers. What were their personalities like? What did they look like?
It's hard to say, actually. Mekhijah was the larger of the two. He was well over 6 feet, had a large head, had long black hair. Mekhijah was smaller and, from all indications, was fiercely redheaded.
You mean Wiley?
Wiley, yeah. Wiley was younger. A lot of people believe that he kind of was the one that had the ideas of what they would do. Mekhijah was more the muscle, if you want to call it that. From all I can find, they were always hatless. They never wore a hat. They didn't wear any kind of animal, you know, coonskin cap or anything like that. Mekhijah was absolutely just, they say, as strong as two or three men. Of course, that was a good way to describe it. Anybody was strong back then. But to say he was exceptionally strong. Wiley was more tended to use a gun more than Mekhijah did. Mekhijah favored a knife or a tomahawk, but there's not really any great, really great physical descriptions other than just generalities. You can say Mekhijah was larger, Wiley smaller, Mekhijah black hair, Wiley red hair, but that doesn't really change anything.
They've long been assumed brothers, but there is some debate as to whether that's true. Some say cousins. What's your take on that?
Well, I've come across all of it. I've read probably, more than likely, more than anybody has read about these guys. I really believe it could be either way. I believe that there's some case to be made for them being cousins. However, in everything that I ever read that had any kind of personal tidbits about the two of them, they never one time called themselves anything other than brothers. I think, again, I believe it could be either way, but they never referred to themselves as cousins. So you almost have to go with brothers up until somebody can actually prove they were cousins. And I've looked for that record and looked for that record and looked for it, and I've never found it. And I've done, again, an awful lot of research on it.
You say in your book that the Harp brothers were America's first serial killers. Can you talk about that?
Well, actually, their story is well documented. Everything from the Kentucky Gazette newspaper printed articles from 1799, which I have copies of, to all of the stories that have been written over the years. And they are well documented. They've been written about as much as most any two people in history. There is a lot of material out there to look at. And I probably read maybe 50 or 60 or more separate accounts. All of the accounts agree in generalities, in the basics. Some of them don't agree in some of the specifics. They're called, I think, America's first serial killer, simply because what you touched on, because they did, in fact, start at one point in time and just killed everybody that they ran into, which apparently that's what they did. There's only a couple of cases where they actually meet somebody in the woods. They actually met a Baptist minister, a Methodist minister, named, what was his name? Lambeth, maybe. Anyway, they met a minister in the woods, and instead of killing, they took his Bible, and Mekhijah opened the Bible and read the name George Washington. Now, this tells you a couple of different things. It tells you, one, he knew who George Washington was, but it tells you, two, that he had enough basic education to be able to read the name when you saw it on paper. You know, they could at least read basic stuff. So they let the preacher go. They said Washington was a good man. So they actually gave him his Bible and his horseback and let him leave. or is he's one of the few people that I can find that they actually came across when they were on the wilderness trail and actually came across this guy and actually let him live. So I guess if you kill 40 or 50 people in a 10 or 11 months, which is what kind of happened in 1799, then you probably qualify as serial killers, more than likely.
I know you mentioned that their murder spree might have been motivated in part by a need for revenge, their loyalist parents' death at the hands of American regulators. But it sounds like they had great respect for George Washington as well. I mean, the enemy of their parents, I would imagine. So it seems a little murky to me as to motive.
Yeah, the only printed motivation that you will ever find, the only thing that anybody will ever find, I don't care how much you look, and I have looked and looked and looked. At one time, they asked Wiley, said, why did you decide to kill so many people? And his answer is actually a classic. It's completely shows a deranged mind completely. He said, Mukaija and I bet all our money on a horse race, and we lost. And we decided we'd just kill as many people as possible to make up for it. Now, that was the only reason that they, either one of them, either one of the brothers, ever gave for what they did. They lost all their money on a horse race and decided to kill people because of it. So they never said it was about revenge. I kind of drew that up myself, or a lot of people have thought that. But that's the only thing that they ever say, is that they bet all their money and lost it and just decided to kill the wrong people. That was, if that, in fact, was a motivator, if that was their motivation, it clearly shows that they were completely crazy. I mean, they were deranged. You don't kill 40 or 50 people because you bet your money in a horse race and lost.
So 1799, as you said, was the year of their notorious killing spree. Can you walk us through that year? Was there something specific that set it all off?
They had moved to Knoxville around 1795, and they had got a cabin down on Canoe River, and they had just left living with the Cherokee Indian who lived down in Nickajack, the village of Nickajack down in below Chattanooga. And they were going to be farmers. They had a cabin. They were raising some livestock, and they were doing a little farming. In 1797, Wiley met Sally Rice, and he got married with Mukaija as his best man. Then Mukaija married Susan Roberts, which is another story that some historians don't agree with, but I can't find anything to actually refute it. He married Susan Roberts, and there's a printed record of that also. This would have been about 1797. At some point in time, along around 97 or in 98, some of their neighbors accused the two Hart men of stealing pigs and stealing maybe some other cattle. So it began a lot simpler than it became. Barns began to burn down, and it turned out that they were the barns of the men who had accused the Harps of stealing pigs. People got shot at, although nobody yet had been killed. So from 1797, mid-1797 through 1798, they were trying to live a normal life, and they began to get accused of stuff, which, again, they may or may not have been guilty of. But if they were or if they weren't, either way, they didn't want somebody accusing them of it. So they began taking some of their anger out on the people that were accusing them. They began to do some stuff, I think. And they finally, in late 1798, decided they were going to have to leave Knoxville. So they picked up all the stuff they had, and they headed out for the Wilderness Trail down through Kentucky. And it was then, after the first of 1799, that they actually started killing people because they were out there on the trail. They had no food, no money, most of the time no horses. So they began killing a person here and a person there that might have some food and might have a horse or might have a few dollars in gold. And it just escalated. From there, I think it became easier and easier and easier. The more they killed, the easier it became to kill. And more than likely, the more they killed, the more the compulsion was to kill. They began to like it, I believe. They liked seeing the light fade out of somebody's eyes, or they liked seeing a head bashed in with a tomahawk. And they may have been doing it, you know, there's no way of knowing what actual part the women played in it. The women could have been just as bloodthirsty as men. We just don't know. There's nothing written about the women. So throughout the early part of 1799, they were just traveling and killing. And as it progressed, then of course the law started looking for them. And then they just got worse. And then they started killing everybody they actually, anyone that they met in the woods.
Back after a word from our sponsors.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we have returned to the interview. And they were well armed, as you mentioned in your book. Rifles, pistols, knives, tomahawks. I mean, they must have been an absolutely terrible sight to behold.
Everything that I can find, it seems that Wiley preferred a rifle as his means of personal whatever, while Micajah actually seemed to like a tomahawk. Now, they both carried knives, and I'm sure they both carried pistols, but the weapon of choice for the two of them was the tomahawk for Micajah and the rifle for Wiley.
Hello all, Eric here. So if you are not a big fan of advertisements disrupting the flow of an interview, there is an option. Go to patreon.com/mostnotorious, and for just $2 a month, get all my episodes ad-free. This will not only be for the Most Notorious podcast, but also for my new podcast debuting in September of 2018 called Where Blood Runs Cold, a collection of terrifying, historical, true crime stories from my home state, Minnesota. And for $4 a month, you'll not only get the ad-free episodes, but bonus content as well, including extra episodes, special commentary, and more. So skip the ads, support the show, and listen to new stuff by going to patreon.com/mostnotorious. That's Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com /mostnotorious. See you there. Cheers. Now back to the interview.
In this killing spree, they didn't differentiate between men, women, or children either. It was everyone.
They didn't differentiate at all. They killed anybody they met. The thing that always strikes me as being funny is people say, well, you know, they kill women and kids. Yes, they did. But here's the fact. If you were a grown, armed, heavily muscled, fierce fighter, man in your mid-30s or whatever, and you met the Harps in the wood, they probably killed you too. They actually had, apparently they had no fear. They didn't differentiate between anybody. If they come across you, they killed you. And they didn't care. They killed men, women, probably killed dogs and horses. I don't know, but they just didn't care. If you met them anywhere along that trail, then they killed you.
When did the law become involved with the Harps? Were there people trying to catch them at all during this stretch of terrible murders?
No. It wasn't until they killed Stephen Langford that somebody could actually tie the Harps to any of these killings. They met Stephen Langford at Little Rock Castle. They went in, it was cold, and they went in to get breakfast. They didn't have any money, so they probably went in to rob the place or kill the guy that run it. But there's a young man in there, a traveler named Stephen Langford. And they met him, and he offered to buy them breakfast, so they bought him breakfast. And then he said he was going to travel on the Wilderness Road, so they offered to go along with him, which was a bad idea on his part to accept it, but he did. And a couple of days later, his body was found. When they found the body, somebody remembered that he had left with these people. And when they started describing the people as two unkempt men, big men, one with red hair, one with black hair, with three women and maybe a couple of kids with them at the time, somebody else put two and two together and said it was the Harps. So that now they have attached the Harps to a real killing. At this point in time, people started saying, okay, let's stop them. Let's go get them. So the funny thing about it was that there is documentation, again, of an 11-man posse that was put together for the express purpose of going out into the woods and capturing Mukaijah and Wiley Harp. And so they did. They went into the woods. And at one point in time, there's 11 grown frontiersmen who are bad to the bone, armed to the bone, and they're looking for two men. They came into a clearing about 50 yards across. And as they're standing on the edge of the tree line, they looked across, and the Harp men and the three women stepped out of the other side. The Harps looked at the posse and started walking directly toward them, straight at them, right across the clearing. The leader of the posse, to show you the mindset of what these two men did to people, the mindset of people that met them, the leader of the posse turned around to the other 10 men and said, look, boys, if they don't start nothing, we won't. The Harps walked right up to them. They parted it. The Harps walked right through them and on in the woods on the other side, and the posse went back to town. So they got all their guns. They got their courage worked up, probably whiskey. They went out into the woods, found the Harps. When they found them, all they came back home with was their tails tucked between their legs a little bit because they were afraid to actually confront them. Here's the theory on that. These guys knew. They knew without a shadow of a doubt that if they confronted the Harps right there, some of them were going to die, probably five or six of them, because these guys were big and they would kill you, and they didn't hesitate a bit. So rather than have two or three men or four or five men or more die, even though they might capture the Harps, they just said, no, it's not worth it, man, let them go. And that's what they did. So there's your mindset on your posses.
So at this point, they knew who they were. They'd ID'd them. How did the story continue from there?
Well, there was another posse actually that went out, and they came upon the Harps sitting on a dead log at a little clearing. They were just sitting there, just the men, no women. They walked up, arrested them, put them on their horses, and headed back for the settlement. And about half of the way there, they turned around and looked, and the Harps were gone on the horses. So they knew they were after them. And they went out to try to arrest them, but the only time they actually managed to get them picked up, they just faded back in the woods and left the posse, not even knowing where they were. Then you had a man named Joseph Ballinger, who was a sheriff that was actually out looking for them, but never really could catch them. So, yeah, the posses were out either looking or pretending to look, but as good as they were, they never actually caught them up until the very end.
Do you think that the women were active participants in the murders? Just complacent? Or were they enslaved?
I don't think they were enslaved at all. You've got to remember that this is the 1700s, and women at that point in history looked at men differently, completely different than they do now. Once you are with a man, or once you are married to a man, which two of these women were, divorce or something like that wasn't unheard of, but it wasn't something that was widespread. Almost nobody did it. The women had, it sounds strange to say security, but in one way, they knew what their life was. They were secure in knowing what they were going to be doing from day to day. It wasn't what you and I might want to be doing from day to day, but it was what they were used to. I think probably after the first two or three killings, I think the women were just as much taken up by the rush of taking another life as the men were. Again, you've got to remember that they were separated from them a couple, two or three times, and they always went back. They didn't have to. They could have went somewhere else. They could have, you know, left the country entirely, but they didn't do it. So, no, I don't think the women were enslaved. I think it was their way of life, and that's the way what they felt they were supposed to do. And at the same time, I believe that they finally were pretty much as caught up in the bloodlust and the killing as the men were.
So Micaiah was the first to be killed. Talk to us about how he met his end.
Sure. In December of 1798, all three women were pregnant. It was a very cold winter, and they managed to get arrested. The two men and three women, pregnant women, got arrested. They were taken to jail, and they stayed there for a couple of months until the babies were born, and then the men left. The women at that point in time were tried and found not guilty. They were given a horse, and they were told not to have anything to do with the harp bin. As soon as they left town, they traded the horse for a canoe and took off to meet with the men at Cavan Rock, which was down on the Ohio River. That led to the events of the summer of 1799. In August of 1799, the harps went to visit a friend of theirs named Moses Stegall, I'm sorry. And apparently he owed them a dollar. I guess it was a dollar. So he had a cabin, and when the harps came to the cabin, his wife answered the door, and Moses wasn't at home. They asked for the dollar that he owed them, and it seems apparent that she had a few more dollars in her purse. They probably decided they would take what money she had, but they told her, ask her if they could stay there for the night. So she put them in rooms. There's some confusion about how many people were there. Most of the stories say there were two other people there, Mr. Williams and a Major Love. Some stories only say Major Love. Anyway, they did, in fact, kill both of those guests, or the one guest. Major Love, when they killed him, they told Miss Stegall they killed him because he snored too loudly, by the way. But some 50 years later, when his wife, Mary, she died, she had inscribed on her tombstone that her husband, Major Love, was killed by the harps. That's how much stigma left on the victims of these men. But anyway, Miss Stegall told him that she wouldn't be able to fix him anything to eat because her baby was sick. Micaiah told her that he said, you fix her breakfast and I'll go in and take care of the baby. So he did. He went in and took care of the baby. He slit the baby's throat, but it stopped crying. Then they came back out, and they killed Miss Stegall, and they burned the house down. So this led to a posse being formed, again, with more determination this time. They were strictly intending to go out and capture the harps, because Moses Stegall was in the posse, and they just killed his wife and child, and he definitely wanted to capture them. So they enlisted the aid of a man named John Leaper. And Leaper was a really good marksman. And they set out searching for the harps. The next day, they actually came upon the harps. And the two harp men by themselves. The women weren't there. But the men ran. They were at a campfire. They ran and jumped on their horses. But Micaiah Harp had a big horse because he was a big man. Wiley had a smaller horse. But when they ran and jumped on the horses, they got on the wrong horse. Micaiah jumped on the small horse, and he took off. Wiley took off too, and he went one way, and the posse decided not to go after him, but they would go after Micaiah, which they did. John Leaper's rifle had got wet, and his powder had got wet, and there was a man named Jim Thompson with him. Jim had met the Harps some weeks before that, and the Harps had given him an entire cup full of powder. So he loaned Leaper, John Leaper, his rifle and the powder, which ironically had been given to him by Micaiah Harp. So they set out to find them, and Leaper got out some few hundred yards ahead of the rest of the posse, and actually came across Harp. He loaded up his rifle with the powder that Harp himself had given Thompson, and he took a shot at him. And actually, although he's 100 or so yards off, he actually hit him and hit him in the back. Micaiah fell off the horse, paralyzed from the waist down, couldn't move. So Leaper advanced upon him. The old language is great, isn't it? He advanced upon him. And when the rest of the posse finally called up, they went on up to where Harp was laying behind a fallen tree, a little log. And he was still, had his tomahawk in his hand and a knife, and his gun didn't fire. So they actually had caught Big Harp. And Stegall was not content that the Harp was wounded or to take him in. He was determined to kill him because he had just killed his wife and child. So Stegall sat down, or knelt down beside Harp, took Harp's own knife, his long knife, raised Harp's head up, grabbed him by the hair, raised his head up, and started cutting his head off, and him still alive. And you may want to edit this out, but Harp's last words were, "You're a goddamn rough butcher, but cut on and be damned." And they did. They cut his head off. They took the head some miles away over toward the Ohio River, over toward where Madisonville eventually was. But they went over into Dixon County, and they nailed the Big Harp's head up into a tree, up into the forks of a tree, and left it there so everybody could know that he was really dead. Everybody could come by and see Harp's head and know that the man was actually gone. So the whole community there became known as Harp's Head, as Harp's Head. And I have not pictures of Harp's Head, but I do know where it was because I found a map, a Kentucky map from 1820 that shows the location of Harp's Head on it. So he was dead, no doubt about it. But Wiley had escaped. So in their time at Cave and Rock up on the Ohio River, they had met a man named Mason. Mason had given up robbing pirates or robbing boulders on the Ohio River and had gone down to the Natchez Trace in Mississippi. Wiley knew that, and he headed south toward Mississippi. He finally met up with Mason, who by this time was known as Mason of the Woods, and he was the most notorious bandit, most feared bandit on the Natchez Trace. But he was not known for killing people so much as just robbing them. But in the next year or so, and from this would have been in early 1800, in the next year or so, the body count around Mason began to grow by leaps and bounds, which one can only assume is because Wiley Harp joined up with Mason, and Wiley was still very bloodthirsty. Wherever Wiley was, there were going to be bodies. In 1804, they placed a price on Mason's head. And so the meanest man on Natchez Trace met up with the meanest man in the world, apparently, because Wiley killed him, cut his head off, and took him back into town to collect a reward. But while he was in town, he was recognized and eventually arrested. They took him back down to right outside of Greenville, Mississippi, and hung him, let his body hang for 3 or 4 days, took his body down, cut the head off, and put it on a stake and put it out in the middle of a field. So it was ironic or kind of strange that Micaiah's head was on a tree somewhere near Greenville, Kentucky, and Wiley's head was on a post somewhere near Greenville, Mississippi. But they're now both dead, and the entire world, or the entire southern part of the world, is breathing a lot easier when they want to sleep at night.
There are a lot of decapitations going on in these stories.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Cave and Rock, where Mason and the Harp brothers often lived and operated. I've actually been to Cave and Rock, and it is an absolutely amazing place. It was perfectly situated on the Ohio River. These guys could just sit and wait and strike from their hideout.
And there's a story that I think is indicative of how mean the Harps were. At one point in time, while they were at Cave and Rock, they stopped a boat, flatboat, sank the boat, and the outlaws are sitting around at evening, right at dark, dividing up the loot, the bounty, the booty, and they noticed that the hearts were with them. And somebody asked Mason, said, "Where's the hearts?" Or whoever it was there, Wilson, whoever happened to be leading that bus at that point in time, said, "Where are the harps?" And they said, "The harps have got the captain of the boat." So about that time, they heard a commotion up on the hill. If you know, up on top of the cave, that's a tall bluff. That's 100, 150 feet high. And the harps had taken the riverboat captain up to the top of the bluff, stripped him off completely naked, tied him to a horse, blindfolded him, and blindfolded the horse. And the pirates are sitting down at the campfire dividing up the booty, and all at once the horse and the captain came flying off the bluff and hit the Ohio River and the rocks. And at that point in time, they decided that the harps didn't need to be there anymore. So they got all banded together and made the harps leave. Now, here's the thing. When you are so mean that pirates run you off, I mean, you got to be bad to the bone. Pirates run these guys off. You can't get any worse than that. You can't get any meaner than pirates running you off.
As you said, you are a direct descendant of the harps. How does that connection drive your interest? Do you feel closer to the Harp brothers because of it, or do you kind of keep those feelings at arm's length?
For the most part, we do like my dad did. My dad would never allow himself to lose his temper. I only maybe saw him lose his temper maybe one time in my entire life. He said, I don't lose my temper because I don't know what I'll do if I lose my temper. So we don't lose our temper. I try to stay standoffish to anger. If I start getting angry, I'll back off and I'll move or I'll do something else. I try not to get to the point where if there's anything there, it might come out. Yeah, we think about it, or I think about it. I think my kids think about it, but I know my dad did. And again, it's because he said, I don't let myself get mad at people because I don't know what I'll do. And I think that's the one true thing that we can hold on to. Just don't get so mad at people that if there is a base nature inside, you don't get so mad that you let it come out.
I guess where I was coming from in that question is that I think it would be both difficult and, in a sense, exciting to be closer to this history because of your familial ties.
Well, yeah, I do. I've always felt the connection. You'd be amazed to know what I actually felt when I went inside Cave and Rock the first time. I mean, it was nobody in there but me. I went down the steps by myself. I went in and I walked back to the back of the cave, and it's like the rocks were whispering. You know, you could hear, you know, just it's almost like I was totally connected with the events and the things and the people and especially the hearts that were actually there in 1799, and it was a goosebump raising event for me. And if I had any doubt that there was a connection, once I did that, I wouldn't have had any doubts left. I felt the connection, and at that point in time, I did. Then again, I like writing about them because they are two really, even though they were pure evil, they are really interesting characters.
Mr. Don Harp, thank you again for your time.
Well, you're welcome.
This has been the Most Notorious Podcast. If you are finding yourself enjoying this show by some small chance, do not hesitate. Go to iTunes and leave a rating and review. What in heaven's glorious name is stopping you, for crying out loud? Go, now! Or maybe just get a snack first and do it later. But please do it. I'm Eric Rivenis. See you later, and good day. Thank you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.